session number 17743, Reel 2.
Mr. Curtis, Reel 2.
Well, the mine's off the north coast of Germany, and of course along the islands that come right along down to Holland, and down the west coast of France, in the estuaries and so on, where the ships went in and out. In fact, my very first raid, which was in January 42, was a mining operation off the mouth of the, it's the Elbe that runs down into Hamburg. The very far end, the last island before you go down into Hamburg, I think it's called Wangerooge, and we had to do fly to there and then do a timed run from there in order to put the mine down. And it was in broad daylight. And it was the first time, of course, that I'd ever seen flak ships and flak coming right over the top of the aircraft from each side. But because you'd see, when you were dropping mines, you were down at about 500 feet. You to put them in the water, you didn't drop them high altitude, you were right down low. And I think the Hamden did quite a good job in this respect. I don't know about bombing, whether they achieved much or not. In retrospect, Bomber Command in total didn't achieve very much in those days anyway.
Did just one Hamden go out to do the mining?
On that first trip I did, yes. But what would normally happen, you'd probably get two or three points to go and put mines down, so you'd have maybe three or four aircraft on from the squadron. It's difficult to remember at this length of time.
Could you drop them more or less where you like?
No. Oh no, you had to put them down because it was you had to put them down in the estuary or where the ships were going in and out to docks. For instance, down the French coast there, Lorient, Saint-Nazaire, and places like that, where the big, the Scharnhorst and the Gneisenau came out in 1942 from the west coast of France and went right up the channel, and they weren't even stopped. We went. It was hopeless trying to bomb big ships like that with 500-pound GP bombs, general purpose. You wanted height and armor piercing. Well, we hadn't got the height because of the weather and so forth, and they just came up the channel. I got an idea one of them was damaged, but it was mainly by a swordfish with torpedoes by the fleet air arm. I can't remember.
In your logbook, you've described one operation as a nickel operation.
Ah, yes, right. Now, that was normally the first trip that you did once you got. Sometimes you did it from an OTU, and sometimes you did it, but in my case, it was done from the squadron. And it was a raid on a fairly... it wasn't in the Ruhr, for instance, which was a hotbed. It was on some place in northern France, and you dropped leaflets. You didn't drop bombs. You just dropped leaflets.
This particular raid was to Rennes.
Rennes, yes, which is...
16th of February 1942.
That's right. And I think that was the first raid I did with Chris.
How did you feel about carrying out leafleting raids?
Well, it was part of the training to go over the channel and so forth and try and find your way around in the dark. But I thought it was a bit of a waste of time. It was not... I couldn't see the purpose of it, although I know quite a lot of leaflets were dropped.
How much danger was there to you on these operations in the Hamdan?
Well, you had the searchlights, you had the flak, and you had the fighters. But we were lucky; we were never attacked by fighters. I didn't do very many anyway, so what happened was this: 144 Squadron, which was the Hamdan Squadron. I suppose at Air Ministry or somewhere, they made a decision that they were going to phase out Hamdans as bombers, and they were going to convert them into torpedo work and send them out to North Russia because the big German ships were down in the ports there, down in northern Norway and so forth, you know, the Tirpitz and so on. And 144 went up to, I think it was Lukers, somewhere in Scotland anyway, and they took only crews that had not done any operations in bomber command. And we were reposted within Five Group, which was, of course, old Bomber Harris was commanding Five Group at one time. He was commanding Five Group when he was actually made CNC Bomber Command. The crews that went up to Lukers were all new crews. Not that I was very experienced, I'd only done a few. But our crew went to Waddington, where we converted onto Lancasters. And it was shortly after the raid, I don't know, the first raid that got any publicity anyway with the Lancaster was the Augsburg raid, which was a daylight attack. And 44 Squadron sent 6 aircraft and got one back, which was Squadron Leader Nettleton. The whole crew were decorated. Nettleton got the VC, and the whole crew got DFCs and DFMs. And of course, they had to have replacements, and we were one of the replacement crews.
Where was 44 Squadron based?
Waddington, RAF Waddington, which is just south of Lincoln.
And 144 Squadron?
North Luffenham.
How did the two stations compare?
Well, they were both very good because they were peacetime. They were original RAF stations, so the facilities were very comfortable.
How did you find flying in the Lancaster after the Hamdan?
Well, we all thought they were rather big, but they were certainly much, much better. They were warmer. I got more light on my table and so forth, that I could see better to do my work, my navigation. And of course, in early 42, spring, early summer 42, we got the first navigational aid that Bomber Command got, real navigational aid, and that was the G. Up to that time, the standard of navigation was, well, as best it could be, but it was not as good as could have been. Of course, all the radar equipment, all the emphasis had been on fighters' defence. And it was only when they started to think about it and that it was necessary for Bomber Command to have some radar help to find targets and to navigate properly. And this G chain was really quite something, and it was British. It was introduced by us, and you got three stations. You've got the master station and two slave stations, and you've got a you picked up your pulses on the screen, lined them up, and then you cleared it down. You got a base, time base there, which you read off your B and C bit pulses, and then you plotted them on a chart, and that was where you were, which was quite unusual. We'd had nothing like it before. The only limitation was the fact that as the farther you got away from the stations, the less accurate it became, because the lines diverged. But it was marvellous, and coming home, homing into base and so on, was perfect, very good.
What exactly would you have in the way of equipment in the aeroplane to operate G?
We had a bit like a small television set today, and you've got an A pulse, which was the master station, which was like that, and then you've got a B and a C pulse, which was like that. And like that, and all you did, you lined them up. And once you got them lined up, you threw a switch, and you got a time base then, and you read off the readings on the time base, and you plotted those on the chart, and that was where you were. It was brilliant.
So the A pulse was a peak, and the B and C pulses were troughs.
Yes, yes, and you lined them up.
How easy was it to line them up?
Oh, pretty good. Yes, it really was a wonderful aid to navigation. The standards went up tremendously after that.
And you lined them up by twiddling a knob?
Yes, you just sort of lined them, sort of you bring them into a line in the middle of the screen.
And would they stay in alignment?
No, because they were only in alignment for the position you were in. If you moved on, your A pulse would stay there, but your B pulse would move out to one side, and your C pulse could move at the other side. So you'd have to bring them back in to line them up for the next position. Well, it was wonderful. It was the first real navigational aid that Bomber Command got.
So how was this information transmitted to the pilot?
Oh, it didn't. Nothing was transmitted to him. It was I plotted it on my chart. I'd got a separate chart on which I'd got all these lines. I haven't got one here.
Don't worry. This has got to be audio rather than visual anyway.
Yeah, quite. You've got your ordinary Mercator's chart on which you did your navigation, which was a basic Mercator, which was all in nautical miles, and you did everything in knots and so forth. And then you've got these separate charts, which you used with the G charts only. These were G charts, which you used with the G, and you lined these things up, got the reading off the G box, and where the two lines intercepted, say it was 3.1 and 10.2, where those lines intercepted, that was where you were, and you read off. your latitude and longitude and put it onto your navigation chart. The pilot never saw anything about it at all. He couldn't hear or see any. It was all visual. There was no sound at all.
Now, do you remember your first operation with 44? Oh, before that, this was supposed to be a Rhodesia squadron.
Yes.
Was there any specific, special Rhodesian characteristic to it?
I don't really know. There were I think what had happened was that Rhodesia had adopted this squadron, because we used to get cigarettes and things like that from Rhodesia, and we had quite a lot of Rhodesian crews or Rhodesia personnel. Nettleton, who I mentioned earlier, who got the Victoria Cross, he was a South African, but in the Royal Air Force. He was subsequently killed. But as you know, all squadrons were a mixture of all sorts: Canadians, Australians, New Zealanders, etc., South Africans, and so forth. I think what it was, Rhodesia was adopted. Rhodesia adopted 44. Although an interesting thing is, reading some stuff about Bomber Harris, when he was a squadron leader, he actually commanded 44 Squadron, which is, but I don't know whether it was a 44 Rhodesia Squadron then, but it's still called 44 Rhodesia Squadron today, because I go to a reunion, I was there this last March up at Waddington, and it was the 75th anniversary of the formation of the squadron, and it's still in being today.
Were there any non-English people in your crew, Lancaster crew?
Yes, the Canadian, bomb aimer was a Canadian. Lofty Cole, he was a Canadian. Chris was from the Isle of Man. Collie, who's the only other survivor, Collinson, he lives up at Sandbach. I see him down again. Myself as a navigator, Paddy Copeland was the wireless op. Oh, Harry Dutton was the mid-upper gunner. And we got a chap named Murphy, who again was an Irishman, in the tail.
Now, I think your first operation, if you can call it an operation, was the 21st of June 1942, when you put North Sea Search dinghy located and crew rescued.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Yes, indeed.
Can you tell me about that, please?
Well, we were called out. It was fairly early in the morning, if I remember rightly. The time should be on there. And there was a... let me put this. If you're going to crash, if you're going to ditch in the sea, you sent out a sort of a mayday signal. You weren't allowed to operate your wireless because of security. You had no wireless. You got messages coming out to you, but you weren't allowed to send messages back to base unless you were in trouble. And if you were going to ditch in the sea, the last thing that you did was lock your Morse key down so there was a continuous signal sent out so that the stations on the coast could sort of plot you, get an intersection and plot your position roughly anyway to within a few miles. And we were given a position off Mablethorpe, 100 miles or so out, off Mablethorpe. And we had to fly to that position and then do a square search. And we actually found the dinghy. I remember this very well. The crew was from 207, which was another five-group crew, squadron. And the navigator had trained with me in Canada, a Canadian named Shapter.
What condition were they in?
Oh, they were okay. They were all in the dinghy. They must have got out pretty well. And, of course, it was summertime, so it wasn't too bad.
Now, coming on to the operations against Germany, the first one you've put is 25th of June against Bremen.
Yes.
Do you remember that one?
Yes.
Yes? If you're ready?
Yes. It's difficult to recall the exact thing, but I think we once, I don't know whether it was one afterwards, when we went to Bremen, and we landed at Wittering. I don't think it was
that. Yes, it is. That's right. You put in your logbook, landed at Wittering.
Ah, that's okay. That was the one. The first one, I think, went off quite well. I think, you know, we were caught in searchlights and the flak and that, but we never had any trouble with fighters at all. None at all. So it was just a normal bombing raid as far as I can remember.
So why did you have to land at Wittering?
Ah, that was a different one. We got at Waddington, where we were based, we were on grass, but it was a peacetime, it was a peacetime airfield, and the runway was limited. And on that night, we had to Wittering, we had to land at Wittering. We had been to Bremen, and we got shot up quite badly. And the result was our hydraulics were holed, and we couldn't get our undercarriage down and our flaps and so on. And we hadn't any brake pressure. So if we'd landed at Waddington, even if we got our wheels down, we couldn't have stopped anyway because we hadn't any brake pressure. We should have gone through and hit the houses at the end. So we were diverted to Wittering, which was actually a fighter aerodrome. And Basil Embry was a CO there, who was later on Chief of Air Staff, I think. He was the group captain there. And he'd knocked his airfield and his satellite all into one. And there was about a 3-mile runway there, I believe. So it was a long one anyway. And we managed to get our undercarriage down and so on, and our so that we could land. What had happened was this: if you lost your hydraulics, we'd got an air bottle in the Lancaster, which you could open, and it would flood the system, and it would lock the wheels down, and so on. Which was, but you'd got to come, you were coming in, and you couldn't go round if that was, see, if you were going to go round again, if you hadn't got your aircraft lined up properly, you wanted to go round again, you lifted up your undercarriage. But if you'd once locked them down with this air bottle, that aircraft had to land. And, so, the air bottle was near me, and old Chris, the pilot, was, he got it lined up and so on, and he said, right, and I opened the air bottle and we locked the wheels down and we got onto the, we landed and we just ran and ran and ran because we hadn't any brake pressure. And fortunately, it was a grass field and we stopped before we hit the far end. But we couldn't have done that at our own airfield. We had to go to Wittering to do it. And we stayed overnight, and ground crew came down the next morning and put the thing right, and we flew back the next day.
Had you been shot up by flak?
Flak, yes. Flak.
There's one operation here in which you put, this is the 18th of July, you put Operation to Essen, one fighter claimed. Returned owing to...
Yes, I remember the cloud cover. Lack of it was. I can remember that very, very clearly. Now...
Oh, this is the 18th of July.
Yes, very clearly I remember that one. This was a daylight. And... it was a Saturday, I remember that too. It was a Saturday. And I don't know who had this fantastic idea, but there was cloud, supposedly, all over Western Germany, Holland, so on. And they decided to send one Lancaster every hour through the day, the idea being to keep, the Hun on his toes and so forth. And what we were supposed to do, I was saying about these G lines, we flew down one of the G lines, and I had to tell the pilot, sort of get him onto the line and get him the course, and then when the other pulse came in, at the time they lined up, I'd say, right, and I would drop the bombs. Or tell the bomb aimer to do it. And this was the idea, that we would go in cloud cover, no problem, in cloud all the way, and so forth. And our instructions were that if we ran out of cloud, we had to turn round and come back. Well, we ran out of cloud just about on the Dutch-German border. It got very thin. And by the time we'd made up our minds that we were going to turn back, these two 109s jumped us. That's right, and Johnny Newton was in the turret, in the rear turret that day. I remember looking out I was standing up looking out to the back, and it was just like a spray, this tracer stuff coming out of these things. And we didn't see this 109 actually hit the ground and so on, but we did claim it as a damaged anyway. And it was a possibility that we had actually shot it down. Most important thing was they didn't shoot us down. But poor old John he was shot through both feet. And he never came back with us again on ops, because he was off for a very long time.
How did that kind of incident in which a comrade was wounded affect morale?
Was quite extraordinary. You know, it didn't. At the time you were a bit upset and so on, but it didn't